Welcome to the StarWeaver Podcast. Here we hope to bring you insights into technology, business, and your career.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Paul Siegel. And today we have Ken Boyd, an expert in the financial arena, accounting arena, among many others, performance areas. Ken, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ken, tell us a little about yourself. Tell us how you got into the finance, the accounting business overall.
So I've really had sort of lived three lives. I'm 58. I started in the financial services business in 1985 and was an investment broker for 4 years before I went back to school and got a CPA. And then I spent quite a few years. I worked in Big Four accounting and worked in accounting roles. And then in around 2000 started to shift into training, eventually became an author, and now I both write and train people full-time in accounting and finance.
And you've written several is an understatement, a bunch of Dummies books, the very famous Wiley Dummies books on accounting. How did that all happen? How did you end up connecting to do books of that sort?
So I started a YouTube channel in 2008 that has about 450 videos on it, mostly on accounting. Mm-hmm. And in 2012, a literary agent who is now my agent was Googling cost accounting because he needed to find an author for cost accounting for dummies. And he came across my YouTube channel and he sent me an email and he said, you know, I watched some of your videos. I think you could write a book. And that's how I ended up writing the first book, which was the hardest thing I've ever done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's how I got there.
Well, hard to put ideas into to text. It's easy to speak sometimes, but then not as easy to articulate them consistently. And those books have a lot of call-outs. They have a lot of details. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of sort of quick, immediate insights that, you know, as sort of the book's whole mantra is to make things really simple, right? And to put that into pointed call-outs and other little phrases that is very hard to do. But you've been at it a long time, so you kind of have been that finance coach for many organizations.
Yeah, and it was interesting, you're right on point. When I wrote the first book, the problem is there's 300 unwritten rules of how to write a dummies book.
Right.
And my agent said, if you can just get through the first one, and I had to get a technical writer help me finish, they'll have you write more. I ended up writing four of them. That also led to video projects at Lynda.com, which is now LinkedIn Learning, and other video sites. So my same agent for literary books also got me video deals, and so that's going on and on.
Yeah. So let's jump into the topic, 8 metrics that improve business results. And in this case, we're obviously very focused on the finance and business world where people are overwhelmed with data. They feel overwhelmed. They don't know how to articulate it. They don't know what matters. So how do you go about sort of culling out metrics that matter in general? Let's just talk about, I'm sure it's hard to do this, but in terms of in general, how do you cull out data metrics that matter? How do you decide?
Uh-huh. Let's use the example of a company that makes mountain bikes. Let's say they manufacture mountain bikes.
Yep.
What's important can be determined several ways. The first is, What are the metrics that are volatile and that change a lot? If you're in the accounting world, what are the metrics that create big variances between what you budgeted and what your actual was? Maybe in the mountain biking example, it's the cost of a certain component part. So that is one way to identify it.
Okay.
Big variances.
Big variance.
The other way to identify it is big dollar amount.
Uh-huh.
So you need to prioritize for big dollar amount. If you're the mountain biking company, that's going to be total revenue, it's going to be cost of goods sold, the big numbers.
Okay.
Ideally, everybody needs a financial dashboard that they create based on those decision points.
Okay. And when you're going through this, you know, big, could, when you say big, is it on both sides? Meaning, is it on the supply side as well as the distribution side? Is it the side of the customer as well as, let's say you're making multiple things, not just a mountain bike, but you're making the handlebar separately, and maybe you sell a seat separately, and maybe you sell some backpacks. How do you do it based on as well the big ticket items that you're selling?
I would start with the product. Let's assume there's multiple product lines, is what you're saying. Start with the product line that generates the most revenue, and then start working your way down. Now, it may be that the CFO is only looking at the metrics for the big product line that, let's say, it takes up the big chunk of business, whereas middle managers are going to have a financial dashboard that looks at other metrics that are further down the line that are smaller. But you don't want a situation where one person is looking at a screen with 30 financial metrics on a dashboard. It's just unmanageable.
And the metrics, need they always be pure financial? Meaning, let's talk about the bicycle. Maybe one of the metrics is the trends in the industry, right? Trends in the industry that will ultimately impact your financials, or attitudes, or other things that you maybe have a harder time quantifying. Are there other types of things that you, even focusing on what you just said, the big things that are going to impact, like COVID? I assume that had a, I know it had a big impact on gyms. I stopped going to my gym, most people did, and then they started buying home equipment or maybe mountain bikes as well. So how do you, I mean, it's, again, this is kind of overwhelming, especially if you're not as quantitative as you are, but maybe you're a software developer, and maybe you're a product manager or project manager, and you haven't had that kind of insight. How do you begin to unravel that? You know, you said, again, the big numbers, but to me, I'm a quantitative, let's say I'm an analyst, I'm thinking the big numbers is, let's say, industry market movement. So how do you...
Benchmarks, yeah.
Yeah, benchmarks. How do you begin to think about that?
So I've written a lot about this COVID pre-world, post-world. So I use the restaurant industry for an example, where restaurants went from in-person dining to carry out and delivery primarily.
Right.
So the first thing is, regardless of what industry you're in, what does your post-COVID world look like? Because a lot of people are not going to go back completely to pre-COVID world. So that's number one. The second thing is, look at the last few years' financials and see what were the things that changed a lot that I didn't contemplate that have affected business going forward. So that might be a material cost that went way up. That might be a labor shortage that's increased my labor costs. And then you make a good point about marketing, which is, our customer trends changing. And that relates to making an effort to do customer research, looking at research in your industry. So the example I use with my mountain bikes is, let's say that customers who buy mountain bikes are telling you that they need a tire that will inflate faster, particularly when they're on the road and they have a flat. So maybe you're trying to create a product to address that need. So yes, there are non-quantitative measures that you need to look at.
And when you're trying to put together, you discuss dashboards. What kind of, you know, obviously that's a big concept. What does a dashboard look like for someone who's looking at financial metrics or other performance metrics? Is it an Excel spreadsheet? Is it a CRM system? I mean, you know, there's all sorts of sizes of companies that have these dashboards. What kind do you like to put together for someone who's just getting going in this arena?
You know, in most cases, companies now use ERP systems, which are company-wide systems that handle accounting, operations, sales, and everything. And the easiest way to do it is to basically build into your screen an extra screen that you don't have to have it on your desktop all the time that generates those financial net metrics in real time based on your ERP system. So your ERP system is spitting out data, collecting it in real time. So maybe you go to your screen once a day or once a week and look at metrics. If you're a manufacturer, maybe you look at gross profit. If you're a retailer, maybe you're looking at inventory turnover. Just some very basic metrics to see where you are. And it's important not to wait until the end of the month.
Right.
This is something you need to look at continually.
And you talk, just for everyone who's not familiar, ERP is Enterprise Resource Planning.
Exactly,
and
right.
And there are a zillion types of them now. Now there's CRMs, there's some that pull financial data, some pull customer data, some pull like Google Analytics, activities, data on your website. Kind of overwhelming on some level. Unless you're a big company, can you do this? Unless you've got department for everything, how does one begin to do this on any, you know, reasonable level, even if you don't have a sophisticated, huge staff?
So let's think of a company that's doing $5 billion a year in sales on QuickBooks. Mm-hmm. QuickBooks, I do a lot of writing for QuickBooks on these topics. Mm-hmm. QuickBooks can spit out dozens and dozens of canned reports. Mm-hmm. And I think a management team needs to get together and go and say to themselves, what are the reports that are really important that generate a lot of variance, that impact our profit? And let's just scale it down to 5 or 6 mm-hmm. metrics, and let's put all those metrics in one place. It could be an Excel spreadsheet if you don't have an enterprise resource system. Mm-hmm. But the key is to really, really narrow it down and stick with what you've narrowed down. Mm-hmm. And admit to yourself, I'm not going to look at everything, but because my time is limited, I have to prioritize.
Yeah. In that case, you know, you mentioned QuickBooks. QuickBooks has a QuickBooks Online version, and you don't need to be super sophisticated. We moved over, for example, to QuickBooks Online, and it made life so much easier. Accountants uh-huh. and others can look at the data, and you can share information, and people can provide you reports. I mean, you don't have to have even one of the biggest accounting firms in the world to have someone come along and say, let's create a report that looks like this, and they create it for uh-huh. you on this ERP, right? Essentially, that's what that is. It's an ERP platform.
And it's also great, that's true, and it's also great because now QuickBooks has tons of integrations. You can integrate and do your payroll, outsource your payroll to a third company. You can integrate it with automated invoicing so that you can plug in so many other tools, inventory management, mm-hmm. so that everything's automated and seamless, so you don't have people creating a spreadsheet and inputting data okay. and dealing with the time and risk of error.
And on top of that, I don't know if QuickBooks does this particularly, and you would know better than I, but I would imagine then pulling the data out and putting it into, if you really get sophisticated, Power BI and other Tableau and other reporting and analytics right. tools that allow you to say, if it's not even in real time this instant, you can quickly pull it out, or sometimes you can in real time, and then overlay a reporting tool on top of that
right.
kind of core, you know, single source of truth kind of database.
Right, and that's possible too. And as QuickBooks gets more and more sophisticated, there's more and more integrations available. That's a big priority for the company.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Talk about also, I mean, one of the things we're going to talk about is kind of the risk of data floating around there. Obviously, you've got a lot of data with a lot of people touching it, and you know, risks of how do you protect your assets when you are dealing with many multiple third parties. You know, whether it's this obviously would apply to all sorts of areas, not just, you know, financial and performance related. What are your some of ideas or hints for best practices in that vein?
Yeah, I'm going to throw on top of that what you just described, plus the fact that with COVID, people are working remotely and are going to stay remote. I think the most important thing is you've got to have a private internet capacity as a company so that no one in your business, whether on a laptop or on mobile, in the office, out of the office, is using the internet. They are using a private network. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, and this gets a little deeper, is if you can have some sort of database management where you can, when people ask for access, they don't have access to everything. So if somebody's going into the system to look at inventory, they don't have access to the rest of the database in case there is a cyber attack. And the third is encryption, which is becoming easier even for small business owners to access. And that is to send data that's encrypted and receive it in an encrypted form. Those are some tips.
And those things are just very common today. Those tools are not even something that you really have to worry about that much. Okay, let's talk about cash flow versus sort of traditional measures of profit. You know, people, you know, have always said cash is king, but always it seems like people concern themselves with profits. So tell us a little about the distinctions, and tell us a little about how one goes about using that as a metric for success and a benchmark.
Yeah, so the example I've used for years is I worked years ago with a company that was a residential plumbing company mm-hmm. that did about $3 million a year in sales. Everybody needs plumbers. They had all the credentials. They did a huge business. The problem is they did residential plumbing. Mm-hmm. The owner entered a contract to do commercial plumbing for an apartment building, and he lost some money, and he also lost some cash. So the result of that was that he had a profitable business that was always short cash. He was always struggling to make payroll. He eventually brought in another investor and sold some equity to get the cash he needed. The reason I say that cash in some cases is more important than profit is the amount of time and effort and distraction it takes to get the cash you need to operate your business, even if you're profitable. So in terms of effort and time, you've really got to get the cash figured out first and then go on to profit. Because if you don't have enough cash to operate, you're just going to spend hours and hours trying to fix the problem.
Talk about also customer metrics. What are important customer metrics to think about in terms of that, in terms of determining which road to go down, if you will, which is the most, where to focus your energies and efforts and where to focus your time?
Yeah, these are three metrics that are becoming more and more used. They used to be tech company type metrics, now they're more widely used. The first one is, and I'll use the example in this case of a repair shop, your car repair shop. Customer lifetime value says, what is the value of a customer in terms of sales and profits over a lifetime? Well, I've gone to my same repair shop for 15 years. So for somebody like me who's satisfied with the product, I might have a lifetime value of 30 years. That's customer lifetime value. Another one is consumer acquisition cost, which is the cost to acquire a company, to acquire a customer. And how long does it take to recover that cost? This is big in the tech world where with so many companies like, let's say Netflix doing subscription business, they're willing to spend a lot to get a customer because with a subscription model, they can make a lot of money after they recover the cost. And the third, and again, it's the Netflix example, is monthly recurring revenue. What can, revenue can you reasonably expect each month from repeat customers, whether you run a subscription model or you run some other business. And those are, I'll say one more metric that I've used a lot. It's from a Harvard Business School study, Business Review. And it says that acquiring customers is anywhere from 5 to 25 times more expensive than retaining an existing customer.
Sure.
So the leverage that you get from repeat business is just massive.
Right. Yeah, and most people don't realize that. It's one of the reasons, you know, you really need to treat the customer well. There's this funny scene from Pretty Woman, I think everyone knows, where Richard Gere is being sucked up to by the salesperson, and he says to the salesperson, "You're sucking up to the wrong person."
Yeah.
Even though he's paying the actress, forgot her name offhand, but
Julia Roberts
is making old purchases. So it's quite funny. You have to know who to suck up to and also how to treat them really well, because they will be the ones who make the decisions. Right?
Right.
And as you said, it's incredibly more difficult to acquire a customer. I've always been marveled at the Skype story, where I've forgotten exactly the numbers and I usually get these wrong, but they had I think about 400 million users with not a nickel in revenue, nor had they planned it. They had, I think, 40 employees. It was kind of nice, even numbers. And I think it was either $4 billion they sold to for Microsoft, and primarily because they had these people like me who early in the day would just use nothing else to make a call internationally. How perfect was this? Free calls from all over the world. So we were very happy customers, and everyone is, in that context. So I think that's really not. It's maybe not as much. It's just such a central point in business that most people do not appreciate. You know, it's when you walk into a small restaurant and they remember you, as an example. There is so much value in that to the business that people just ignore, and they don't treat their customers the way they really should to drive the business to be big pretty quickly. So,
and restaurants during COVID are a great example.
Yeah.
I mean, like most people, there's 4 or 5 restaurants that I would get carry out or delivery from, and it's those same restaurants because the customer service is great and the food's good.
Yeah.
And I'm a repeat customer. Now that we're starting to end a little bit, I will end up indoor dining at those same places down the road.
Yeah.
And it's just a huge advantage.
So let me ask you again, you know, let's go back to this metrics issue, because there's always going to be what I'll call the professional kibitzers. the people, a word that many people from New York use, which means people who will look over your shoulder and constantly give you advice, which may or may not be valuable. So you have people who are professional kibitzers who get paid a lot of money for that, and at the same time, you know, I've had experiences where we have a hugely well-regarded company comes in, well-known brand name, and they give you advice, and then you realize that their advice is not nearly as good as the small independent contractor who's been there, done that, and lived your pain. And so how do you cut through all of this and really be, I mean, is it time will tell? You just monitor a bunch of these metrics and realize which the ones are powerful for you? Or, I mean, at what point do you were saying, you know, pick those metrics. How do you know? How do you, you know, and especially you don't have a lot of people around you, but you're a small business, you're trying to get it done right, and, you know, everyone's telling you different things.
Yeah, and that's the problem. So there's two answers. The first is, I think talking to industry peers is critical. Mm-hmm. I think industry benchmarks is critical. And, unfortunately, there is a lot of trial and error. Where if you're using a benchmark of mm-hmm. gross profit, let's say, mm-hmm. and the gross profit in your industry is 40%, and your gross profit is consistently 35%, maybe there is some sort of restriction that is preventing you from getting up to the industry average that you just can't overcome. So you may 9 months into it say, you know, I've got it at 35%, for some reason I can't get any higher, I'm just gonna live with it, and I'm gonna try to find something else that I can change to make an improvement.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing I think on some level is that most people fear talking to mm-hmm. peers who could potentially be competitors. But to me, I think that for the most part, most normal humans, at least in my view of the world, who, even if you're allegedly a competitor, you know, short of you're being the only two gas stations in town and they're right opposite each other, most people share information and will tell you maybe not their secret sauce, but they will tell you enough about their information to be very helpful to you, and not in even competitive to them, but just competitive in the market, if I'm being clear. In other words,
absolutely.
Yeah, the people are mostly willing to share, especially if you're not aggressive about requesting the information, and you develop
relationships with them. Right, and I've seen this in every industry, that people, I see veteran people are willing to ask those questions to peers, and that new people, until they learn the industry and the people and realize that there's some openness, they won't do it.
Right.
But industry veterans do it all the time. They talk to peers all the time.
Yeah, and I think most people will tell you, and you know, many entrepreneurs who have been entrepreneurs very only recently think that they have the secret sauce. They can't tell anyone, and then therefore they never get their idea off the ground, they never get their business off the ground. But the reality is, most people, the more you share, the more you learn, and the more you realize if it's a market worth pursuing, there are many people in the market already in one form or another. You know.
Exactly. And if there's one mistake, I was just talking to my wife about this over the weekend, if there's one mistake I've seen in business is not willing to take what you think is a good idea and find somebody to collaborate or partner with and going it on your own.
Right.
I have two friends in different industries who each spent over $250,000 on an idea that didn't work, largely because they would not bring in a partner or a collaborator
right.
to help them get where they needed to go.
Yeah.
They wanted to keep it a secret, and it right. just doesn't work.
Right. I've had a family member who had a friend had an entrepreneurial business, and they had this idea, which is a clever idea. Wasn't going to change the world, but that's fine. Most businesses don't. Most ideas don't. But it was a very close friend of a family member who was afraid of telling me about it for fear that I might, and wanted me to sign an NDA. And I said, look, with all due respect, you know, I'm not going to sign an NDA for no reason. Then you don't trust me. If you don't trust me, then why would you even tell me anyway? So I think a lot of it has to do with, if you trust, then you have to develop trust. I mean, this is old school thinking. You know, a legal document like an NDA is not going to protect you from anything other than it actually won't. It won't protect you from buying the services of a lawyer.
Right.
You know, so the best thing to do is to develop understanding and good antenna for determining who you can trust, and then, as you said, build partnerships, build relationships, and those things are so critical. And most people, maybe I'm sounding like I'm standing on a soapbox here, but I think you've hit it on the head, which is, you need collaborators in your business, whether they are equity collaborators also, whether they're you know, revenue, whether they're just people who are good advisors and you'll be good to them at some point in the future with free meals at your restaurant, who knows, or free mountain bike discounted or whatever.
It's critically important. And I mean, I've tried to, this is so ironic, before I wrote Cost Accounting for Dummies, I was actually going to write a cost accounting book by myself, and I was going to try to market it myself, self-publish. It just wasn't the right thing to do. And ironically, I was approached about writing the same book for Wiley 3 months after I had the idea to do it myself. Mm-hmm. I'm all about collaboration. You're a lot better off.
Yeah, and I think the phrase goes something along the lines of, you know, it's no telling how far you can go if you don't need to take credit for it. So
right.
And I think that also goes back to the original discussion about metrics and whatnot. I mean, the asking people for advice. You know, it's sometimes hard to do that, especially if you're a proud entrepreneur or a proud business owner or a proud head of a product area within a big tech company, asking people who are maybe even younger and say what they think. I ask people who are half my age, who I work with, who work for me, what they think about things, because if I can't, you know, there's no better way to get insights from my perspective, or about what, as you were discussing at the very beginning, what should you measure? Right, because people have different insights into that, and you might find someone who has very little experience but really brilliant insight.
Yes. And it's also true in my writing world that on a dummy's book, there are 6 different layers of editing. Mm-hmm. And so you have to very quickly admit that this is a collaborative process,
right?
And you're willing to take some criticism in some direction, and you end up with a better product. Yeah. I mean, at the very beginning of my first book, I was sort of resentful about it. Now I realize, hey, I want a good editor. And in fact, I was able to pick the editors on my later books who I'd worked with before because they were so great. And that's collaboration too.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of funny that when you think about metrics are measuring suppliers, customers, your staff, you know, people talk about measuring human capital, all sorts of things. At the end of the day, many people, myself included, don't know exactly what to measure, right? You don't know what's important. But getting that input from collaborators, from people in the industry, from advisors, is, you know, is invaluable and something that can't understate. And hard for people often to ask. I don't know what to measure. What's important? I think, as you pointed out, you don't need to hire a high-powered consultant to get that insight. You need to ask questions.
No, you do. I mean, in cost accounting world in particular, it's the manufacturing people who know. For example, you're making mountain bikes and your people tell you, you know, we're buying this metal for a certain piece of the bike and it keeps failing. I think we need to go out and find another vendor because we're wasting too much material. Or we need more training for the labor force for construction, manufacturing, because they're not trained well enough, they're making mistakes, there's waste, it's taking longer to make the bike. Only the production manager has that information. That is not an outside consultant.
Right.
Only the manager does.
Right.
So that's an example.
And it might also be that in the case, I was thinking also you might have been going in the direction of, you might have just talked to the manufacturer of that product
of the part
and say, here's my problem. As opposed to just cutting them off, they might say, aha, the problem was that we knew this was a problem. If you were doing it this way, we're recommending people do it that way now. So it's not you don't necessarily have to cut off a partner necessarily. You might be able to say, just here's my problem and help me fix it. Or if you can't help me fix it, then I'll go elsewhere.
Great, that is a great point.
Yeah.
Because vendors are hard to find, and it's hard to find a vendor who will give you a good price, ship reliably, send you a quality product. Yes.
Right. Well, thanks, Ken. This is great insight. I really appreciate your time, and let's do this again, and looking forward to having your courses on our platform.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it. Have a